been a full decade since Dave Isay, a radio producer, started inviting people, regular, everyday people, to step inside a recording booth and talk to each other about the things in their lives that are important to them. He named the project StoryCorps, and since its inception, it's recorded tens of thousands of personal stories, preserving them for the people involved and also for history. Every Friday, NPR's Morning Edition airs a segment featuring a distillation of a StoryCorps recording session, segments that many find incredibly moving and which have earned Dave Isay 2 of his 6 Peabody Awards. Tales from StoryCorps have also been collected in books. The 4th and latest collection is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps, just out from the Penguin Press. Dave Isay, welcome to Focus.
Hi, Jim. It's great to talk to you.
Tell me about the new book, Ties That Bind. How does this differ from the previous ones?
Well, you know, we thought for our 10th anniversary book, we wanted to do something that really drills down to the core of what StoryCorps is all about. One of the main reasons that people do a StoryCorps interview, and we've done about a little bit more than 50,000 of these so far with about 100,000 people, because people come in pairs. One of the reasons people do this an interview is to honor the person they feel most grateful to in life. And those are basically the stories in this book. It's a book of Thanksgiving to mark the 10th anniversary of an undertaking, which is so much about connection and kindness.
When you started to put this collection together, were there some segments that you just knew were going to go in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of interviews to choose from. I mean, we got 50,000 interviews down to, I don't know what it is, 40, 45. That really kind of crackle off the page. And I should say that, you know, radio stories don't a book make. These are not transcripts of the stories that you hear on the radio. The way that we do this to kind of preserve that poetry that we try to our best to present every Friday and make it work on the printed page is we put the voices as best we can out of our heads and go back to original transcripts of interviews and read them for as they appear on the page. So I don't know, maybe half, three quarters of the stories in the book are from the radio, and the others are just are stories that never made it on the radio, but work as written word. You know, I think of the story of O'Shea Israel, who went to StoryCorps with Mary Johnson about 17 years ago. O'Shea murdered Mary Johnson's son. And she ended up about 15 years into his prison sentence going to the penitentiary to find out who this person was who had taken her only son away. And they developed a friendship, and when he was released from the penitentiary, he actually moved in next door to her. And they've developed a mother-son sort of relationship, and it's one of those extraordinary stories of connection and forgiveness and kind of humanity at its very, very best.
One thing I'm struck by, and sometimes listening to the Morning Edition segments of StoryCorps, I feel like I'm listening to some distilled happy endings.
Yeah.
But in a way, often these are happy endings that have taken a lifetime to achieve.
Yeah, it's funny. I was at a book event today, and someone came up and talked to me about a story that he wanted to tell at StoryCorps about a kid of his who... when he was a couple years old, he was in a car accident, and the kid almost died, and the kid ended up living. And there are so many stories where you don't have that sort of happy ending that show up on StoryCorps. But you know, one of the things that we hear so much from people, especially in the last couple of months, is that StoryCorps stories make them, you know, cry when they hear them, despite that moment at the end of hope. And I think that the reason StoryCorps stories make people cry so much is that, you know, first of all, we're surrounded by kind of so much phoniness, and these stories are authentic. I mean, the people who come to StoryCorps, the opposite of reality TV. Nobody comes to get rich. Nobody comes to get famous. It's an act of generosity. And also in the case of, you know, like Mary Johnson, you're hearing humanity, you know, at its best. And I think that can be very... very moving for people. But, you know, the stories, the distillation of the stories are very true to the stories that are told in the booth itself. I mean, obviously, we're taking one out of every, you know, 500, 600, 700 stories and cutting it way down. But one of the, I'm on book tour now, and one of the great things about being on book tour is getting to meet the people who are in the book. many of whom I've kind of gotten to know by listening to their story on the radio and seeing that, you know, not only are they as you know, fantastic as they are in the book or in the radio stories, but invariably they're kind of even more amazing than they appear in print, which makes me think that we are doing an accurate job of distilling these stories.
One thing I'm struck by with StoryCorps is that this is really a project which gives control over this whole recording session pretty much to the participants. And is this something that's interested you over the years? I'm thinking of the project you were involved with about 20 years ago, Ghetto Life 101,
yeah.
Where you gave tape recorders to a couple of kids in inner city Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely one of the inspirations, and I did many pieces of just kind of giving tape recorders to people and letting them record their stories. And you know, again, going back to that idea of the microphone giving you the license to ask questions you don't normally get to ask, and with those two kids in Chicago who are now not even young men, they're in their mid-30s, the interviews that they did with people growing up with them in the Ida B. Wells, many of the people in the documentary have since died, you know, the vast majority of the people, and these tapes became the only record that they had of their loved ones' voices. And, you know, that's the power of radio. The soul is kind of contained in the voice. I think of StoryCorps as a public service, as almost a social service. You know, documentary work traditionally has been about recording interviews or filming interviews and creating a work of, you know, art or an educational work that's disseminated hopefully to a lot of people. And doing projects like the project in Chicago, I came to believe over the years that the act of actually doing interviews, of having the opportunity to speak to a loved one, of having the opportunity to be asked, you know, what have you learned in life, how do you want to be remembered, that could be transformative in people's lives.
When you were first proposing this project to the people who were, I guess, ultimately paying for it,
yeah.
What was your elevator speech for them?
Well, I think everybody thought I was insane. And we were, when we started StoryCorps, it was a small project. We were, you know, four or five people. Now we're, you know, 110 or something like that. Still, I think we still have a long way to go, but it was very small, one booth in Grand Central Terminal. And I had been lucky enough many years before to win a MacArthur Fellowship, so I used the imprimatur of that to say, you know, I've got this crazy idea, but I hope you'll back it. And a few people and organizations, including the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, decided to make small investments in StoryCorps and give us a chance. But the early days were rough, and, you know, there was a point in the first year where we were within a couple weeks of having to shut the whole operation down because we just ran out of money, and then we had a couple of good breaks over the next couple of days, and we've kind of grown from there. But the dream with StoryCorps is that someday, you know, we'll grow into a sustaining American institution.
Well, for the participants in StoryCorps, and I gather that some of them may come in really knowing nothing about the project or about the fact that there's a segment that airs on public radio
yeah.
every week. How do you explain the process to them?
Well, first of all, most people, I mean, we do encourage people to prepare before they come in. So we have something on our website called a question generator where you've got the, you know, I don't know, 10 dozen most popular StoryCorps questions and then hundreds of others you can choose from. When they come, they're ready. You know, the facilitator whose job is basically kind of bearing witness to these interviews and in a sense are, you know, traveling the country, collecting the wisdom of humanity, are there to guide the interview process. And, you know, what the facilitators say to people before they start the interview is ask that question you've always wanted to ask because the 40 minutes go by so quickly. When you're done with the StoryCorps interview, you can sign a release that puts the interview in the Library of Congress so your great-great-great-grandkids can listen to it and also allows us to put it on NPR and in books. Or you can't, or you don't have to, and we don't really care if you don't do it. If you don't sign a release, you walk away with both copies of the CD. We erase your name from the database. There's no record you've ever been to StoryCorps. You put it in your bank vault, and hopefully you know, it'll last for many years, and you can share it with your kids and your grandkids. When StoryCorps started, I thought we'd have a compliance rate of 70 or 80% because I saw how intimate these conversations were from the very, very first interviews. And 50,000 interviews later, it's about 99.6 7 or 8%, which speaks to people's, you know, desire to leave this record of their lives.
40 minutes is the time length that you mentioned a few minutes ago. Tell me why that works best, do you think?
When I made radio, public radio documentaries for years before starting StoryCorps, I found that after, you know, when you have a very intense conversation, the energy level after, you know, 40, 45, 50 minutes began to flag. And I, you know, there are fantastic documentarians like Errol Morris, who does the 24-hour interview method and does phenomenal work that way. But I always found that a shorter interview with an intense conversation at the top was the way to go. So that was one reason. The other is that we needed to run these things on a schedule because people would come in for interviews one after another. And I knew we needed 5 or 10 minutes at the top to do some data entry and 5 or 10 minutes at the back end to finish the data entry, sign releases, and have people cool down. So 40 minutes with 10 on the top and 10 on the bottom so that we ran on an hour schedule was a guess that it would work, and it's worked very well.
Now, what people hear when they listen to the segments on Morning Edition or even read the books are just snippets from the 40 minutes.
That's right.
With all the stuff that, with all of the total content, and I understand this is preserved in the Library of Congress?
Yes.
How do you see that being used in the future, or are people looking at it now?
Yeah, a lot of people are looking at it now. There's all kinds of research projects going on with the material, everything from kind of linguistic research to you name it. We are going, over the next several years, we're going to make the archive, the full archive, public online. You know, I have some issues around informed consent that I and the organization want to work through before we kind of turn that switch. But in the coming years, those participants who are comfortable having their interviews shared with everybody will have the opportunity to do so, and then you'll be able to search the entire, all of the interviews that have been made public, all 40 minutes of those. And, you know, the facilitators who are in the booth when these interviews happen are keeping written logs of what happened. So you can search at, you know, 10 minutes and 30 seconds, you know, Joe Johnson spoke about the Battle of the Bulge or whatever it is. So it's a highly searchable archive. And I think will be a really interesting resource for people.
What's it like listening to some of the full interviews? Have you heard many that are just as gripping as those very edited, distilled ones?
You know, I think of it as almost kind of concentric circles of interest. You know, I lost my father a little bit more than a year ago. He died very suddenly. He was, you know, working on a Friday and then got sick on a Saturday and was dead by the next Friday. And I had recorded an interview with him. When I listened to it the night he died at 3 in the morning, you know, the whole 40 minutes, so that's when the rubber, you know, really hit the road for me, and I fully understood everything we were trying to do with StoryCorps, and every word of that interview obviously is more interesting to me than, you know, anything that we'll put on the radio and so forth. So, I mean, I think for families, the entire 40 minutes is extremely interesting. What we present to the general public are stories that have this kind of universal quality that demand that they be shared with a larger audience. But again, if this makes sense, it kind of goes out in concentric circles. So your interview with your grandmother will be extremely interesting to you and somewhat less interesting to relatives farther away, and maybe interesting to people on your block. And as you get farther away and farther out, unless it's got that sort of universal quality, it won't have the kind of draw that the stories that we distill on the radio do, except to you.
At the same time, it sounds like researchers might find this, since you're talking about literally tens of thousands of people taking part here, really a good resource to just to hear the stories of people's experiences from this particular time in America.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's a big enough archive that you can research LGBT stories from the 1960s from, you know, the Northeast, and there'll be enough material there that you can draw something, you know, substantive out of that. And we do see a lot of research like that going on. And I do think that, you know, we don't know what this archive is going to mean 100, 200 years from now. I mean, I do know that for the ancestors of for the generations to come of the people who are recording, this will be enormously valuable. But for historians and others who are trying to understand what life was like, how it was lived, I think it'll be really interesting. But, you know, I think of StoryCorps as a project that's really kind of collecting wisdom. And I think we've seen that wherever we go in the country that while the accents change and the jobs change, you know, the stories, what people choose to talk about in this 40 minutes where they're distilling their lives is very, very similar. And they're kind of the great themes of human existence. You know, it's about our parents. If we have kids, it's about our kids. You know, death and love. And that's what everybody talks about no matter where they are.
Now, it was a couple of years ago that my co-worker Sean Powers interviewed you for WILL. And back then, he told you about how some kids learning English as a second language at Booker T. Washington Elementary School in Champaign used essentially StoryCorps techniques. And, I mean, not by coincidence, I think they were deliberately modeling after StoryCorps to tell their stories. And you talked then about wanting to bring the StoryCorps approach into the classroom. And I see that if you go to the StoryCorps.org website, you can find out about a program for high school students called StoryCorps U. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. We're still piloting the program. We're in four cities across the country in high-need schools. And essentially, it's a program that teaches the StoryCorps method and uses StoryCorps stories, both audio, written, and we've done animations now, which you can find on our website or on YouTube, it's keyed to the Common Core standards and teaches hard skills, but it's also about fostering connectivity between teachers and students, helping teachers get to know their students and vice versa. So that school connectedness is really at the core of what this program is about. There's been a bunch of research being done on it out of Harvard, you know, it's very exciting. I think it's got a lot of potential, and is very much aligned with the core ideas of StoryCorps. And if you're going to boil down StoryCorps into one line, it would be that every life matters. You know, I know that we were in, and we are in schools in Chicago now. That's one of our cities. The researchers from Harvard were working, doing preliminary research before we started our program this year, and you know, did a survey in a classroom of kids and asked the simple question, does your life matter? These are 9th and 10th grade kids. 40% of the kids answered no. You know, so that's sort of the kind of space that we're in and where we're trying to, you know, move the needle a little bit.
Do you partner with other groups on some projects?
We do. So we partner with about 500 nonprofit groups a year.
Wow.
And that's across the country. And that helps us really, you know, document the whole scope of the, you know, American experience. And I think that, you know, for people who may feel kind of least heard, that idea of participating in StoryCorps, working with their nonprofit to help them, you know, find out about StoryCorps, come to the booth and share this experience with a loved one can be particularly empowering. So that may well be one of the many, many, many nonprofits that wonderful nonprofits that we work with across the country to make sure that we're capturing the kind of full swath of American voices.
The recordings from those projects also go into the StoryCorps archives?
To the Library of Congress, yep. They all do. All the facilitated interviews do. You know, we get a lot of requests from people who say, you know, I videotaped my grandfather, and can you take it for StoryCorps? And unfortunately, we can't for many reasons, including the fact that we have, you know, very kind of stringent restrictions from the Library of Congress on the quality of the interviews we can put in there, and also the kind of releases that are filled out. But every interview that is done through a StoryCorps facilitator enters the StoryCorps archive.
Tell me about the television program that's airing on the POV series around Thanksgiving.
Sure.
I know it's called Listening is an Act of Love.
Yes.
What's it about?
This was the title of our first book. We started... You know, you asked about the education programs, and I, you know, I'm a radio fanatic and a strong believer in the power of the human voice. I knew that in order to appeal to younger people, we were going to have to find a visual element to add to these stories. We'll never have cameras in the booth, but there were some animators, actually one of whom used to be a StoryCorps facilitator, who started animating these things, and I saw what they were doing and realized they'd found a way to not only kind of not subtract from the magic of the StoryCorps stories, but to add to that. So we've been doing animations that air on POV, on public television, for a couple of years. And on Thanksgiving night, our first kind of special, half-hour special, which is like StoryCorps' Charlie Brown Christmas, will air on PBS. And it's several StoryCorps stories together that kind of speak to the core values of StoryCorps that we've been talking about. I'm actually animated in there, kind of narrating the thing. I'm doing an interview with my my nephew, Benji, and looking very much like Fred Flintstone. But it's a really wonderful special and a great sort of Thanksgiving moment. You know, we ask people on the day after Thanksgiving every year to take an hour out and using your own equipment, whatever you have it on hand, to interview a loved one as the least expensive but one of the most meaningful gifts you can give. So Thanksgiving is a holiday that StoryCorps has always had some focus around, and we're thrilled to have this special airing.
Well, that really brings us up to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the National Day of Listening on the day after Thanksgiving. That's the 29th of November this year.
That's right.
You've been doing this, I guess, 6 years now?
I think so, something like that.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from just, because this isn't something they're going to send into you.
Right.
But what sort of response have you gotten?
Well, you know, I hear from people every day as I travel around the country talking about StoryCorps. I wish I had interviewed my parent, my grandparent, a friend, but I waited too long, you know. So this is kind of a call out to tell people, even if you can't participate through StoryCorps, you know, do this. Take the time to sit across from a loved one and ask them who they are, what have they learned in life, how do they want to be remembered, to tell them how much they mean to you. And, you know, the feedback is terrific. There's a lot of school groups who participate in this. And you know, it's the fact that we do this the day after Thanksgiving, it's not, you know, we came up with that day, you know, but we hope that people will do this anytime around the holidays, you know, anytime that they have the opportunity to have these sorts of conversations. So, but we did do it the day after Thanksgiving, and a lot of people are participating, and we're going to try and grow it every year.
There's a National Day of Listening website at nationaldayoflistening.org with a lot of information. But I was wondering, Dave, if you could just briefly give just a couple of guidelines for anyone who would want to record an interview with someone important to them.
Sure. Well, one is you'll want to prepare before you do it. So go on the StoryCorps website or National Day of Listening and use the question generator, pick those questions you want to ask. And then, you know, we all have digital equipment. Most of us have digital equipment that we can use to record an interview, your cell phone or your computer. Go to a quiet room, shut the door, no TVs on, no distractions, turn off your cell phone. If you have a microphone, use the microphone, put on headphones if you can, so the headphones can kind of act as your ears to make sure you're getting the best possible quality recording. If you have a device that you're interviewing someone with, you want to hold it about a spread out hand's length away from the mouth of the person who's being interviewed, and then have this experience for 30, 35, 40 minutes, an hour. You know, two things I can guarantee. One is that you're going to find out things that you never knew about this person, no matter how well you think you know them, and the other is that you will never regret it.
Well, Dave Isay, I wanted to thank you very much for talking with me today about StoryCorps.
Thanks, Jim. Happy holidays.